This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
In Parshat Ki Tavo, the section of the klolos, the section of the curses, this is not the only place where the curses are mentioned. There's a whole set of curses which we have here in Ki Tavo, and in the Chukotai, in Vayikra, we've got a similar set of curses that are listed. There are a couple of interesting differences between the two sets of curses. The one difference that I'm going to start with is a difference in an image which is used in the two curses, in the two sets of curses. In Vayikra, this is now in chapter 26, verse 19, the Torah tells us as a curse, V'shovalti es ge'od uzchem, and I shall break the glory of your power, V'notzati es shemeichem kabarzel, V'es arzachem kanechusho, and I will make your heavens like iron and your ground like copper. Whatever that's meant to mean, one thing it obviously means is that there's no rain. Whatever it means, be that as it may, in Devarim, in today's Sedra, the same image is used, but the other way around. And the heavens above you will be copper, right? In Vayikra, we're told the heavens will be barzel, the heavens will be like iron. In Devarim, we're told that the heavens above you will be like copper, the ha'oret, and the land, asher tachtecho, which is beneath you, barzel, will be like iron. A very strange image in the first place. And secondly, the switch of the image seems to be a hint at the essential differences between the two sets of curses, between the two klolos. Rashi notices this and says the following in Dvorim, this is now chapter 28, verse 23. Bahayu shomecho asher al roshecho nechoshes, klolos halalu Moshe mipi atzmoi amoron. The klolos, the curses here listed in Devarim, were stated they were composed by Moshe himself. Obviously, with the approval of God, there's nothing in the Torah which is not there with the full approval of God. But in the case of Devarim, of the Asedra today, Moshe composed these klolos himself. V'shebahar Sinai mipnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu Amaron. And those klolos which were mentioned at Mount Sinai in Vayikra were in fact designed by the Ribono Shel Olam. As it in fact is clear from the language, says Rashi, there in Vayikra it says, V'im lo tishmu'u li, and if you will not listen to me, V'im telchu im mi keri, and if you will go with me in such and such a way, etc. All the situations there are described in the first person singular. God talking, saying, if you will do this to me, then I will do this to you. Here it says, and you must listen to the voice of Hashem your God. Yadbek Hashem Becho. God will bring all these diseases on you. God will do this, God will do that. Here it's clearly not God himself talking. Here it's Moshe talking about a curse which God will give if they don't go in God's way. So that's the one difference already we have now. We have firstly the difference that the ones in Vayikra are stated by God, whereas the ones in Devarim are stated by Moshe on behalf of God. Hekel Moshe Bekil Eloisov. Furthermore, says Rashi, Moshe understated the klolos a little bit. He reduced their potency a little bit. He made them less strong than the klolos in Shemot, and the curses in Vayikra. Why? La Omran Beloshen Yochid. He here uses, when he's talking to the people, second person singular. He's talking to each individual, not to the whole of the people of Israel. Whereas in Vayikra, the Ribono Shel Olam is talking to the whole of the people of Israel. And everything is in the plural. You nation, will be wiped out in such and such a way. All of you people will have all these terrible things happen to you. Whereas here, Moshe always talks in the singular. You in particular. He's not talking necessarily about the whole nation. But Gamkin, and furthermore, Biklola Zu Hekel, he furthermore lightens the effect of this Klola. Shebarishoyne Su Oymer, in the first ones, he says, Et Shemechem Kebarzel, the Altachem Kamechusha. In the first ones, it says, I'll make your heavens like iron and your land like copper. Rashi tells us a principle of metallurgy here, which sounds right, I don't understand it, but let's take it as it is. In any event, this is an image. It doesn't make terribly much difference, but the image is one of iron being totally dry, it being impossible to sweat any moisture out of iron, apart from actually melting the iron. Whereas copper, one can actually sweat moisture out of it, even if one doesn't melt the copper altogether. So he says in Vayikra, he says that the heavens will be like Barzel, the heavens will be like iron, that there will be no drop of moisture in them whatsoever. And therefore the whole world is going to become desolate, because there will be absolutely no moisture in the air, it will be like iron. That the earth will give forth little droplets of water, there will be a little bit of moisture in the water, the same as if you heat up copper, little bits of moisture start appearing on the surface. But that's no good. That's going to cause the vegetation to rot. The fact that there's such heavy heat, and despite that heat, there's moisture in the earth which you can't get rid of, and there's no rain coming down, whatever, that's going to cause the vegetation to rot and to deteriorate. But the Kanu Amir Shemecha Nechoshes V'Artzecha Barzo. Here Moshe switches it around. Shiyu Shemayim Mezin. Heavens will give little tiny droplets of water, like copper gives droplets. It doesn't do much good. It doesn't help. But there'll be some water there in the heavens. Afati Shelo Yariku Mata. No rain will come down. No fear, none of that. But potentially there'll be water in the heavens. Mikol Makom Lo Yecherev Shel Avodon Ba'olam. Nevertheless, here Rashi says a strange thing. It says no rain will come down. But nevertheless, there won't be a complete destruction of lot in the world. Why not? I don't know. We'll see. And the land which here is compared to iron, not to copper, won't give any moisture at all. And therefore the food won't, the produce won't become degenerate, it won't deteriorate. Nevertheless, says Rashi, don't think that this is no curse. Klolohi is a terrible curse. Whether it's copper or iron, it doesn't make terribly much difference. Loi totsi peiros. The earth will not give forth any fruit. Bechein ha-shomayim lo yariku matar. And so the heavens won't give forth any rain. So there's going to be no produce. There's going to be no rain. Nevertheless, Rashi says, this is lighter than there. Because here the heavens are like iron, are like copper, not like iron. And there they're like iron, not like copper. What difference does it make? And furthermore, says Rashi, at least here it's not a complete write-off kind of destruction. That's very strange. Why isn't it a write-off destruction? Rashi says further on that there won't be any fruit, there won't be any produce, and there won't be any rain. So it is a write-off. The same as there. What's the difference? And this really brings us to the third difference between the klolos as they are recorded in Vayikra and the klolos as they are recorded in Devarim. That is, the mood is different. It's difficult to pinpoint it, but the stresses and the moods are different. The stress and the mood in Vayikra is one of desolation, of total destruction and desolation. And I'll just read you one little section of it for you to get the feeling. You'll see by the number of times that the word Shemomo is mentioned, desolation, you'll see what the mood is. V'nasati yesareichem chorba, and I will make your cities desolate. V'ashimosi yes mikdasheichem, and I will make your holy places desolate. V'lo ariach b'reach nifrechachem, and I won't take any notice of your sacrifices. V'ashimosi ani yesareich, and I will make the land desolate. V'shomamu alea oyeveichem hayoshvim bo, and your enemies who sit on it will make it desolate. And you I will scatter among the nations, and after you will come the sword. And your land will be desolate, and your cities will be destroyed. I mean, there's a clear mood there of total wiping out, cleaned up, desolate, destruction, nothing left at the end of it. Looks a little bit like one imagines Hiroshima must have looked after the bomb. That's the kind of description. Nothing there, flattened. You'll go off to some distance. Things are mentioned, but there's nowhere near that same degree of stress on Shemona, on desolation. And there's an introduction of another mood which doesn't appear in Vayikra. Let me read to you the relevant parts of this new mood which is introduced here. Yakho Hashem b'shigoyin uve'ivorin. God will smite you with shigoyin, with going crazy and with going blind, with the timhain levels and with empty hearts. And in broad daylight you'll go feeling around, groping around the way that a blind man gropes in darkness. And your ways will not be successful. And you'll be oppressed and stolen from all your days. Nobody will save you. You will marry a woman. The ishacher yishkoveno, and another man will take her away. Bayis tivne v'loy seishev bo, you build a house and somebody else will live in it. Kerim tita v'loy techalalenu, you plant a vineyard and you'll never have the opportunity to use it. Sholcho tavuach le'inecha, your oxen will be slaughtered in front of your eyes. V'loy toichal mimena, but you won't get any food from it. Chamoycho gozul milafonecho, your donkeys will be stolen from you. V'loy yoshev lach, and nobody will return it. Your flock will be given to your enemies. Nobody will save you. Here there's a different mood. There's not this desolation. You are building houses, but you won't live in the house that you built. You are getting married and having families, but you're not going to land up getting married to the woman you thought you were going to marry. You are planting vineyards, but you're never going to enjoy the wine from your vineyard. So the land is not so desolate. There's activity. Business is taking place. What's wrong? The essence of it, the Torah actually mentions in the very words. You won't be successful. That's all. You'll work and work and work, and there won't be success. That's the new element introduced to the second set of curses, which doesn't appear in the first one. So again, the first set of curses were given by the Ribbono Shel Olam, the second ones were by Moshe on behalf of the Ribbono Shel Olam. The first set of curses is in the plural, the second one is in the singular. The first set of curses refers to the heavens as being iron and the earth as being copper, and the second set refers to the heavens as being copper and the earth as being iron. The first set of and this is the most important part, the first set of klolos have in them a mood of total destruction and desolation. The second set of klolos have a mood where things are happening and everybody's busy, but there's just no success. It's not going like it should be going. That's the problem there. And that's what we've got to understand. What is it that causes this second set of flawless? What is it that causes this lack of success? Everybody's working, everybody's planting vineyards and building houses and doing what they should be doing, and it doesn't work. What's gone wrong? That's what we've got to understand. There are three things that one needs for success. The first thing that one needs for success is you've got to know what you want. Now I want to read you a definition of the sipurna of success, which will form the basis of our definition, which is our definition in fact. The sipurna right at the end of the sedra, we'll come back to the pasuk on which he speaks a little later. But meanwhile, let me just read you the sipurna. Success, says the Sipurna, the very last Sipurna on the Sedra, is Shetasigu Hamechuvan Bechol Ma'aseichem, that you should achieve what you set out to achieve in all what you do. That's success. That's all. You've got to define what you want, because if you haven't defined what you want, there's no basis on which you can or cannot be successful. Success simply means achieving your end. Doing, managing to reach the goal that you set for yourself. That's what success is. And if you're unable to reach the goal which you set for yourself, then you're unsuccessful. That's it. You can't say afterwards, well, my goal was too high. Doesn't matter. That's the goal you set, and you didn't make it. that's unsuccessful. So the first thing you need for success is mechuvan. You need the right kavana. You need to know what you want to achieve. You need to be able to define what you're achieving. You've got to be going places. A man who's not going places can't be successful, because you can only success is measured in terms of reaching a destination. But if you're sitting at the railway station, you can't get to the destination. You've got to get onto the train and start moving. So a man who's not moving cannot achieve success. It's necessary to be moving and to know exactly where you're trying to get. Whether you get there or not, that's another thing which we'll discuss. But it's necessary to be moving and to know where you're trying to get. The second thing you need is perception. You need to be able to analyze a situation. You need to be able to understand the situation to the full. If there's something lacking in your perception of the situation, again, it's going to be very difficult to make a decision which is successful. You want to make an investment today because you figure out that in 5 years' time certain things are going to happen and your investment is going to bring you in a lot of money. For success, number one, you must know what you're aiming for. So you're aiming to take your R1 million and invest it, and in 5 years' time you're expecting to have R10 million. If you've got your R10 million in 5 years' time, you will have been successful. If you don't have your R10 million in 5 years' time, you will have been partially successful or maybe not successful at all. You need perception. You've got to be sure that your analysis of the investment, of the decision, of the circumstances, of the trends over the next 5 years, all that has to be correct. So you've got to have clear perception. You've got to be able to analyze the situation and be confident that you've analyzed it correctly. And then there's an amazing element that you need for success. Talent. That's it. People recognize the part played by talent in all sorts of other areas. But somehow people don't recognize the part that's played by talent in the day-to-day business of living. We talked last night about being a professional liver and being an amateur liver. Can someone pull out the phone and do whatever needs to be done to middle of the shoe. We can still pull it out. They can carry on using it. The part played by talent is something which one clearly understands. You can take a man who understands the techniques of playing the piano perfectly, and he knows all his musical theory perfectly, and his finger dexterity is perfect, and his everything, he knows a lot. Academically, the top man in the world in music. But it's possible that you can have such a man, and yet he just doesn't have the talent to make it sound good. And he sits down and plays, and it sounds dumb. It sounds routine. It doesn't sound exciting. It doesn't have that element which actually moves you. It doesn't have that element which actually makes you stop and say, this is unusual. I could never have heard this anywhere else. This that I'm experiencing now is unique. It's different. It's alive. Something's happening. I don't know what. That's talent. And we recognize it when it comes to playing music, or to driving in motor car races, or into anything. But we somehow don't realize that you need talent just to live successfully. We do. Living is an art, and the same as you need talent in any other art, you need talent in the art of living as well. Don't despair. I'm not going to leave you in the lurch thinking that if you don't have musical talent, you might as well not carry on living. Developing the art to live is something which everybody can do. Because the Ribbono Shel Olam didn't want us all to be musicians, so he didn't give us all artistic musical talent. He didn't all want us all to be Rembrandt, so he didn't give us all artistic talent. He didn't want us all to be Harry Oppenheimer, so he didn't give us all business talent. But he did want us all to live. So he's given us all the potential to have the talent. He's given us, in fact, the talent we need to live. It just has to be utilized and fulfilled and exercised correctly, otherwise it becomes dormant. So you need to know where you're going, and you need to be on the move. You need perception and an analytical ability, and you need talent. I'll now read you a pasuk which I read very quickly when we read it the first time. And I'll translate it the way Unkelus translates it, not the way the English translates it. Unkelus, for those of you who don't know, is one of the very early translations of the Chumash. It's a translation from Hebrew into the Aramaic, and every respectable Chumash as the Unkelus printed on the side, because it's probably one of the most authoritative translations of the Torah, and as any translation, it must inevitably be a bit of an interpretation, we regard Unkelus as being a very important parish, a very important interpretation of the Chumash. Unkelus himself, many of you know, was originally not Jewish, he was a convert. Yakcho Hashem b'shigoyim uve'ivorim, God is going to smite you, says to Unkelus, betipshusa, with foolishness, a disease called foolishness. Tipshus, you're going to be a tipshus. Now what is a fool? A fool is not a shoyte. A shoyte is a person who's insane. A shoyte is a person who's mentally not able to make it. A fool is mentally in order. He just makes a fool of himself every time he tries to put it into practice. Every time he tries to do something, he makes a mess of it. That's a fool. We'll see in a moment still what it is. Tipshusa. Uve ivorum. And I'm going to smite you with some yuto, your eyes, perception. Uve simhain levo, says Unkelus, uve sha'amonus libo, you're going to be emotionally and spiritually bored. You're going to experience boredom spiritually and emotionally. And when you're bored spiritually, that means you're not going anywhere. And if you're not going anywhere, you can't be successful. So here we have the disease. We don't yet know why God's giving us the disease. But here's the disease. What follows is simply the symptoms of the disease. Here, in essence, is the disease itself. The disease is that you're going to be a tipesh, you're going to be foolish. You know, to develop talent, you can't develop talent by studying theory. Talent can only be developed by actually practicing. By tremendous practice, by practicing over and over again, by doing it wrong and having to redo it and figuring out why you did it wrong and making sure that it doesn't happen again and correcting your academic understanding, because you only noticed by the fact that you played the musical piece quite a little bit incorrectly, that was a sign that you actually understood it a little bit incorrectly. And when you heard how you played it, you realized that you didn't quite understand it. So you work out what you understood wrong and you put it right and you carry on. That's the way you develop talent. Talent is results from a give-and-take relationship with the world. When you're busy giving and taking, you can adjust yourself at all times to the requirements of that particular situation, even if it's not perfect. That's what talent is. Talent is the ability to be imperfect when the situation demands such imperfection. Talent is the ability to take two imperfect parts or 10 imperfect parts and put them together in a way where the total is perfect. That's what talent is. And you can't be a perfectionist for that. And you can't be an idealist for that. For that is just a question of talent. A person who can take a couple of flowers and some old pieces of sticks and leaves and put them into a vase that the whole thing looks beautiful, that's talent. That's taking separate things which each on their own are not particularly beautiful and putting them into a way which fits into the room and it fits into the atmosphere of that particular place. Why do we think it's beautiful? Because of the way it so perfectly matches everything in its environment, everything around it. Now, if a person is a tipesh, if a person is not putting into practice his theory, that's when you've got tipshus, that's when foolishness emerges, because he's not comfortable at putting it into practice, and that's when you can't develop talent. A musician was telling me last night that they did an interesting experiment with Bach and a computer. It was a particular piece of music where a certain harmony starts, a certain section of the orchestra plays a certain harmony, and after a certain number of bars at a particular note, another part of the orchestra starts playing another harmony, and each harmony on its own is a beautiful piece of music in its own right, but in addition to that, by virtue of where the second one started, the two of them fit in perfectly together. And the rhythm of the two harmonies matches up exactly, and the harmony and counterpoint of each one of the two together match up correctly. The two together create a perfect harmony. And they figured out that Bach didn't have to start exactly at that point. There are various places in the musical piece of the first theme where he could have started his second theme. And they wanted to figure out why he chose that particular point to start the second theme. They figured out that the same musical perfection could have been reached by starting the second theme at different points, either a little bit earlier or a little bit later. And so they got a computer, and they fed in all the information, all the mathematical, structural, and musical structural information that the computer needed to know, and they asked the computer to determine mathematically and musically which was the most ideal place for the second harmony to begin. And they programmed this thing over months. They worked on it very hard, and they asked the computer to give, I think it was 6 alternatives. The ideal one, first, second, third, fourth, and so on. And the computer spat it out, all 6 alternatives. The one was by far better than any of the others. The first was by far head and shoulders above all the other options. And then option 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 were listed. They found the computer was absolutely right. The one that the computer had chosen was absolutely perfect. On the basis of musical theory, there couldn't have been a more perfect place to start the second harmony. They were surprised to see that Bach came fourth. The Bach's option was the fourth option of the computer, and they analyzed the computer's 6 options, and they were satisfied, and these were the top musicians in the, some of the top musicians in the world that were involved in this little experiment. They were satisfied that the computer was correct, that the order in which it had listed the options was the correct order. Then they sat down to play the music the way the computer wanted it, and it sounded too awful. And they played a second option, and it sounded bad. And third option sounded equally bad. Fourth option was perfect. Funny situation. Bach knew all the musical theory, but he also realized that sometimes when a thing in terms of a theory is perfect, it can make an awful mess when you try and put it into practice. And talent is the ability to change perfection slightly when you put it into practice to make sure that the sum total effect is perfect, that the whole thing is achieving the desired effect. After all, music has to sound. You've got to listen to music. It's not made for computers. It's made for people. And it is possible and feasible, and this these students proved, that you can have music which is perfect in terms of musical structure and doesn't sound right in terms of what music is meant to sound like. And so sometimes one has to deviate slightly from the perfect in order to create perfection in an imperfect world. That's the essence of talent. That's what talent's all about. And a tipesh, a foolish man, is not an idiot. A foolish man is an inflexible man. A man who learns how things are supposed to be and then tries running the world the way it's supposed to be. And it doesn't work. And that's the kind of man we call a tipesh. A man who's got all these 3 qualities that we're talking about here, furthermore, in English one could also call him a fanatic. I don't like using the term fanatic, because usually one can describe a fanatic as anybody who's slightly to the right or the left of yourself. And usually one finds that definition works, that no matter where you're holding, anybody who doesn't agree with you is either fanatically right or fanatically left. But there is such a thing as a fanatic. A fanatic's not Meshuga. A fanatic's an idealist. He's got an idea, and he's learnt it, and he's studied it, and he's satisfied that it's right, and like a bull in a china shop, he tries to apply it, as it is, without talent. A fanatic, I'm talking about a healthy fanatic, not a crazy fanatic. A healthy fanatic is a man who doesn't have the flexibility of talent to try something, listen, see whether it's right. If not right, alter it slightly, tune it, sharpen it, de-emphasize, change it, try another angle, until it's just right. You know, we listen to music and we read poetry and we read literature and we think that the fellow just got up one day and wrote it all out. And if one looks at the manuscripts, sometimes the 10th and 15th and 20th version of the manuscripts already, he's thrown out the first 19. If you get hold of the 20th one, all the scratchings out, and the rewriting, and the arrows backwards and forwards, and moving something here, and moving it there, until it sounds right. If there are no rules of music, why doesn't he just do it right the first time? He knows all the rules. It doesn't work like that. Sure, there are rules, and you need to know those rules precisely. Otherwise, you can't practice the art. But you also need talent. And talent is the ability to alter the rules slightly, to create the correct effect in total, ultimately. Where's all this leading? Why does the Ribbono Shel Olam give anybody this disease of lack of success? Right. So to be successful, you need 3 elements. You need to know where you're going. You mustn't be bored. You need to be traveling. Once you're traveling, you can get off one train and get onto another train. But when you're sitting at the station, you're going nowhere. So you need to be moving. You need perception. And you need talent. And the Ribbono Shel Olam threatens here, or rather Moshe on behalf of the Ribbono Shel Olam threatens, to take away the 3 ingredients we need for success, the result of which will be Isha Teyores, Vishache Yishkavena, you'll get married to a woman and somebody will take her away from you, you'll build a house and somebody else will live in it, you'll plant a vineyard and somebody else will take it, your motor car will get stolen in front of your eyes and it will never be returned to you. Ashlumil, that's what it is. And one has to be very careful. One has to be very careful to ensure that one doesn't start idealizing Shlemielkat. That's a very easy thing to do. Just to imagine a guy who never, he can never make it, whatever he does doesn't work, but he's trying, and he's got a good heart, and he's one. It's a klola, it's a curse. There's nothing pretty about it. There's nothing cute about it. There's nothing even sympathetic about it. It's ugly. To see a man who tries and tries and tries and it doesn't work, that's the klola. There's a lack of success. That means either he's not going places, he doesn't know what he wants, or he doesn't have the necessary perception, or he doesn't have the talent. It's tragic. There's nothing pretty about it or beautiful about it. To be oshuk v'gozu, oppressed and have people stealing from you all the time. Nothing to God, oh, the goyim have always hated the Jews, that's how it's meant to be, that's how it's meant to be. It's not how it's meant to be, that's a curse in the Torah. Hate the Jews or not hate the Jews. You're not meant to be oshuk v'gozu. You're not meant to be oppressed and stolen from. You're not meant to be a shlemiel. The brachas, if you read the blessings, it's that whatever you touch will turn to gold, virtually. Whatever you do will be successful, without terribly much effort. That's bracha. Lola is the other way around. Why does God bring it on us? What have we done wrong? There's one last difference. There are many differences, but for the purposes of this evening, there's one last difference between the klolas in Vayikra and the Tzlolos here in Dvorim. And that is the introductory sentence. In Vayikra we're told the following. Again, this is chapter 26, verse 14. Ve'im loy tishma'u li, and if you will not listen to me, ve'loy tasu es kol ha-mitzvos ho'ele, and you will not do all these mitzvahs. Ve'im b'chukoy tayti masu, and if you will despise my statutes, and you will find my laws ugly, not to do my mitzvahs, to annul my deal with you, then I also will do, etc., etc. That's how it's introduced in Vayikra. The important words are the first ones, which I'll read again. And if you won't listen to me, and you won't do all these mitzvahs. Let me now read you from our Sedra. This is chapter 28, verse 15. Now, it will be, Im loy tishma b'kol Hashem Elokecha, if you will not listen to the voice of God, okay, in Vayikra it says tishma uli, if you will not listen to me, here it says if you will not listen to the voice of God, that's understood why, because here it's Moshe talking, there it's God talking. Lishma la'atzes is called mitzvos of a chukosa, to keep and to do all his mitzvos and chukim. There's a slight difference. There it says, if you will not listen to the voice of God to do the mitzvahs. And there it says, if you will not listen to my voice and you will not do the mitzvahs. Doesn't sound like a very significant difference, does it? But it is. Ours says, and it will be, if you won't listen to the voice of God to do his mitzvahs. And there it is, and if you won't listen to the voice of God and won't do his mitzvahs. The difference, of course, is very simple. Here we're saying, if you won't listen to the voice of God, which is to do his mitzvahs. Whereas there we're saying, if you won't listen to the voice of God, that's one. And you won't do his mitzvahs, that's two. There are two things wrong in the case of Vayikra. Let's look at Rashi in Vayikra. Ve'im loy tishmu li, and if you won't listen to me, says Rashi, what does that mean? Li hayos amelim batoyo, to put tremendous work and effort into the understanding of Torah. The Lodas Medresh Chachomim, and to know the learnings of the Chachomim. That's what it means if you won't listen to me. Ask Rashi Yochel Lekiyum HaMitzvahs. You might think, no, if you don't listen to me means you don't observe the mitzvahs. There are two things we're playing around with here. The mitzvah of learning, knowledge, understanding, and the physical rituals of keeping the Torah. Says Rashi, this that it says in Vayikra, if you won't listen to me, that means if you won't learn Torah, if you won't understand. Maybe it means if you won't keep Torah, no, because you won't have a loy pasu. The very next thing it says, and you won't do. have a kiyum mitzvah. That's what it means. That means you won't do the mitzvahs. What then does it mean, lo tishvu? It must mean you won't learn. So Rashi learns very simply. This is, since it says, one of the things that bring on the curse in Vayikra is lo ta'asu, you won't do. And in addition to lo ta'asu, it says you won't listen. Listen must now be something separate from doing, therefore listening must be not learning the Torah. Therefore says Rashi, the way you've got to learn it over there is, v'im lo tishvu li, and if you won't listen to me. And as a consequence of not learning the Torah, you're not going to keep the mitzvahs. And as a consequence of them not keeping the mitzvahs, in the chukos aitim osu, you will despise the chukos, etc., etc., etc. A whole chain of events that all emerge from not learning and understanding. However, in Kitovo, in our Sedra, Rashi doesn't say anything of the sort. He doesn't say anything. He's silent on the matter. But from what he says in Vayikra, and from the slightly different language here, we can see that that doesn't apply. Because how does it work here? It says, and it will be if you don't listen to the voice of God to do the mitzvahs. So to do the mitzvahs is not something additional to listening. In Vayikra, where to do something, to do the mitzvahs is additional to listening, I have to say that listening means learning. But here it says, if you won't listen to the voice of God to do the mitzvahs, which means we're criticizing you for not doing the mitzvahs. We're not criticizing you for not learning. So we're talking about two different kinds of people. In Vayikra, we're talking about a man who is not learning Torah, he's not trying to understand, he doesn't go to Shiurim, he's not learning Gemara, he's not learning Halacha, nothing. And as a result of that, his Shmirat Mitzvah starts deteriorating. He starts keeping less and less. As a result of that, he adopts a negative attitude to keeping Mitzvahs. As a result of that, he adopts a negative attitude to people who do keep the Mitzvahs, and so on and so forth. In Devarim, this morning we were talking about somebody else altogether. This morning we were talking about a man who is learning Torah. He does go to Shiurim. He is learning Gemara and Halacha and Chumash and Ashkofa the lot. Every day. He's not being criticized for not learning. But he's not keeping. He's not keeping the mitzvahs. And it doesn't mean that he's not keeping any of the mitzvahs. It means he's not keeping all the mitzvahs. Now, a man who's not learning and not keeping the mitzvahs, that's one kind of animal. A man who is learning and is keeping only some of the mitzvahs, and there's a terrible tendency that when one speaks of mitzvahs, by the way, people think of Orach Chaim, they think of the first part of Shulchan Aruch, Shabbos, davening, tefillin, Yom Tov. That's what people think when you talk about keeping mitzvahs. But there are four parts to Shulchan Aruch. There's a Yoredeya, which is Kovod Chaveiro, showing honor to a friend, Tzedakah, Kovod Rav, Kovod HaTorah, Kovod Av V'Em, respecting a mother and father, respecting a Rav, respecting a friend, respecting Torah. There's Evan Ezer, laws of marriage, how to relate to a wife, how to relate to women altogether, how women should relate to men. There's Chosh and Mishpat, which is the biggest section of the whole lot, laws of business, straightness, integrity, character, uprightness. When we talk about keeping the mitzvahs, we're not talking about Orach Chaim. The Sipurna points out in Vayikra, and the same thing applies here in Dvarim, that says, Kol HaMitzvahs, all the mitzvahs. Now a man is learning Torah and not keeping everything he learns. That's a funny kind of animal. That's a man, why is he not keeping everything he learns? He's selective, he's keeping what's easy for him. He keeps either those things he's used to, he's been brought up keeping, or he keeps those things that make sense to him personally. If there are things that he is not keeping, and he is not keeping, then it's as if he's not keeping anything, really. Once you're selective in Torah, this I'll keep and this I won't keep, that's Reform Judaism, that's not Orthodoxy. Orthodoxy is whatever I learn, I will keep. I will do my best to understand it. I will do my best to get to the bottom of it. I will integrate it. It will become part of me. But once I know it, once it's there, I've seen it, and I have clarity as to what it says, I shall keep it. That's how it should be. Which is worse? Is the animal in Vayikra worse or the animal in Devarim worse? So the Medrash in this today said on another subject says the following: Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta said Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta, Kol mi shelomad divrei Torah ve'enu mekayim. Anybody who has learned Torah and doesn't keep what he's learned, his punishment is much worse than somebody who has never learned at all. What can this be compared to? And he gives the following example. The Melech Shehoyolo Pardes. A king had a very beautiful garden, very beautiful orchard. Hichnis Letoichoi Shnei Arisim. So he brought two managers into this beautiful garden. Echad Hayono Tea Ilanois Umekatsatson. One was planting trees in the garden and then chopping them down as they grew. Be'echad lo hayon noteach kol ikar v'lo mekatzon. And one used to sit in the sun and he used to smoke dacha and he didn't plant and he didn't cut. Ami ha'melech koyim. Who is the king going to get angry with? Lo al oisir shayon noteach mekatzon. Who is the king going to get angry with? Surely he's going to get angry with the one who's planting and chopping down. Kach kol mi shalom adu ve'etenevein ha'mekayim oisir on shechomu mi shlo lomad kol ikar. Likewise, somebody who has learned Torah and doesn't practice it is worse than somebody who hasn't learned at all. This example that the Medrash brings is terribly important because it's very precise and accurate. What does the Medrash tell us? That the gentleman in Devarim, in today's Sedra, is worse than the one in Vayikra. That's clear. What did Rashi tell us? Hey, Kel Moshe. Moshe made the clawless in Devarim in our Sedra lighter than the ones there. Firstly, he put it in the singular, not in the plural. The heavens give a little bit of moisture, although it never rains. It's a little bit better than it is there. Why make it better if the object of the curse is a worse human being? So we have to understand. What does Rashi mean when he says that because the earth, the sky is copper and not iron, there's not total devastation? Nevertheless, it won't rain and nothing will grow, but there's not total devastation. Why? There's a big difference. It's natural, I was told this morning, that there should be moisture in the air. That's how nature is. Eventually the moisture will come down as rain or as dew or whatever it is. As long as there's a drop of moisture in the air, even if it never rains, at least we know nature is still functioning. It's still there. The ground is dry and the air is moist. No rain, okay. But nature hasn't gone chaotic. Nature hasn't gone haywire. But when the Shemayim, when the heaven becomes like where there isn't one drop of water that can be sweated out, not one drop, it's totally void of moisture. And the land has moisture. That's an Olam Hafuch. That's a chaotic, weird world. Where nature has gone mad. And that's a terrible clue. Says Rashi, at least here in Devarim, it's not a destruction of Avodah and it's not total loss. Nature is still working. We can't benefit from nature. We get nothing from nature, but nature is still working. One day it will come right. Whereas in Vayikra, nature stops working. And that's much worse. So we see, in fact, as Rashi says, that the klolos, the curses here, are lighter than the curses in Vayikra. Whereas the Medrash says that the man we're talking about here, as we've explained him, is worse than the man we're talking about in Vayikra. But you know, these things which the Torah mentions in Devarim, are not mentioned in Vayikra. To marry a woman and somebody else steals it. To build a house and somebody else takes it. Nationalizes it. Just save up your whole life and you build your house finally and it's your dream house. It's got everything you want and all of a sudden they decide in some foreign country that there should be a change of government and the new government comes into your country and says that house is now mine. Nationalizes it. What a clue. What a curse. What tragedy. To build and to work and to try and to put in effort and never to make it. Always to be the shlumim. Always have the bad luck. Never successful. Groping around like a blind man in the dark. Never getting to where you're trying to go. Walking around in circles and circles. That's terrible. And that's not mentioned in Vayikra. So there are really two things. We've got to look at these curses in the way they affect nature and in the way they affect the individual. The klolos, the curses of the human being suffering is as a consequence of nature having collapsed. That's bad, but at least I don't lose my pride. What can I do? It's not raining. It's not my fault. I've done everything right. At least the individual is not knocked. Whereas here, nature carries on operating. So nature is left better off. From the point of view of the world and nature, the klolos is smaller, the klolos is lighter. However, the individual is a shlemiah. Whatever he tries, despite the fact that nature is still working, he can't make work. That's a pain and suffering which is greater than this. Let's look back again at our king. Says the Medrash, who is he going to get more angry with? With the manager who's lying under the tree smoking dacha, or with a man who's working hard day and night, but he's planting and chopping down, planting and chopping down. Says the Midrash, of course he's going to get angry with the second one. Of course, because the second one shows that he doesn't understand what he's supposed to be doing at all. The first one's just lazy, so he'll get sacked. But the second one is destroying what he's building. That means he doesn't understand the beauty and the purpose and the function of the whole orchard. The lazy one can at least say, I'm lazy. It looks all right. I didn't know you wanted anything more than that. He's got an excuse. But what excuse has the first one got? So the king is going to get more angry with the first one. Sure. But let's forget the king a moment. Let's look at Mother Nature. Who is Mother Nature more satisfied with? Who's the Ribbono Shel Olam more satisfied with, really? With the first one. Because it doesn't say that he's okay with the trees. It doesn't say he uproots them. He chops them. So when you get rid of him, at least there are roots in the ground. At least the tree can grow up again one day. It looks an awful mess at the moment. It looks ugly and destroyed at the moment. But at least there's potential there. So nature feels more kind towards our first manager, and the king feels more kind towards our second manager. And these are the two situations you've got here. In the first Klolos and the Klolos of Shemot, it's nature which is hammered. We'll see in a moment why. Whereas in the Klolos of Devarim, it's the individual who's hammered, not nature. Why? The first one's talking about a man who's never learned. He doesn't learn and he doesn't practice. If there's no Torah, there's no hope. There are no roots in the ground. What can happen? There's no Torah in a community. If people aren't involved in learning and studying and reading and working and in talking to one another in Torah, in trying to understand, even if they're on the wrong lines, if there's no Torah at all, there's absolutely barren. From the individual's own false point of view, he's not that much to blame for not keeping the mitzvah, because he doesn't know. What can you expect? But when God looks at his world, he must be more upset when there's no Torah at all. What are we talking about in the second case? We're talking about a man who is learning Torah, but he's not practicing Torah. That's terrible. We'll see what's wrong with it in just a moment. But at least the roots are there. One day some teacher will walk in and he'll show them what they're doing wrong and he'll put it right. And at least something can happen one day. There is Torah that's wrong. It looks destructive. It looks desolate. All the trees in the orchard are chopped down. But under the ground, there are roots. There is Torah going on. There's an attempt at learning, even though it's rotten learning. But the roots are there. Something can grow ultimately. And therefore, in the second clause, in the second curse, God doesn't hit nature. Nature's fine. The roots are there. God hits the man who's doing it wrong, the man who's making a mess. Let's understand now why the man is making a mess. He's learning and he's not doing. Sorry, before I explain this, I'll use the Gemara to explain this, in fact. The Gemara says, we're nearly finished, the Gemara in Avodah Zorah, based on a sentence at the very end of this Sedra, the last pasuk of this Sedra, in chapter 29, verse 8, is, and you shall keep the words of this covenant, and you shall do them, in order that you should be wise in everything that you do. Says the Gemara, a fascinating Gemara in Avodah Zorah, that you test on the day 19b. Kol ha'osek b'Torah. Anybody who deals in Torah, anybody who's studying Torah, mechotov matzlichim lo. His business will be successful. Doesn't have to worry, everything will be alright. This is written in the Torah and it's written in two other places as well, but the first place it brings it from is the Torah, because it says, the very passage we just learned, that you should keep the details of this covenant in order that you should be wise and successful in everything which you do. It says the Gemara, you see from there that if you keep the covenant, if you learn Torah, if you osek the Torah, then everything will be successful. How can the Gemara learn something from that passage, from that verse, when we've just learned from the whole parasha that comes before it, from the whole section before it, we've just learned that we're talking about a man who's learning Torah and is a shlemiel. Everything he does goes wrong. He has no success. How can the Gemara do such a thing? The Gemara comes and says, "Kol ha'osek b'Torah, anybody who's learning Torah, mechotov matzlichim lo, his business will be successful." And here we're studying a man who's learning and learning and learning, and his business is in a mess. Whatever he does, doesn't work. How can you do such a thing? Here we have the understanding of the word Oisek B'Torah. We use it every morning. We say a bracha every morning. Baruch Atah Hashem Eloheinu Melech Haolam, Hashem Kedoshonu B'Mitzvosov V'Tzivonu, and He commanded us La'asoik B'Divrei Torah, to deal in Torah. And it's a bracha we make for learning of Torah. But what does it mean La'asoik B'Divrei Torah, to deal in Torah? Esek also means business. To deal is exactly the right word. La'asoik, to do business in Torah, that's really what it means. Imagine in business, if you had 500,000 rand to invest, that you didn't need the income or you didn't need the growth at all. Made no difference to you. You're a multi-billionaire, and the 500,000 rand, it makes no difference to you at all. If it's lost, or if it doubled, or tripled, it's irrelevant. Imagine you go into business that way. What are your chances of success? Zero. On the other hand, take a man who's on his last legs, he doesn't have another meal for tonight. He's got 10 cents in his pocket, and that's all he's got. And he walks past somebody who's selling something for 8 cents, and he figures, I'll buy it for 8 cents, and I'll sell it for 12 cents, I'll make an extra 4 cents. And he does it, and he makes an extra 4 cents, and now he's got enough maybe to buy a slice of bread for tonight, so at least he can survive tonight. Don't worry about tomorrow. And he spends his whole night working out what he can do with his 14 cents. That man will become a millionaire. That man's going to make it. Because it's urgent for him. He's got to make it. He has no alternative but to make it. La'asoik B'Divrei Torah means do business with Torah. When you're studying Torah, when you're learning, when you're listening to a shiur, when you're studying a text, there must be urgency. You must need it. If you don't need it urgently, if it makes no difference to you what the result of that learning will be, then you're not going to make it. Your business decisions would be wrong in business, and your Torah decisions are going to be wrong when you make your Torah decisions. You've got to have the responsibility to understand the urgency of what you're doing in order to analyze the thing correctly. And here we have the definition of what makes a shlemiel. A shlemiel is a man who doesn't appreciate the urgency of the decisions he's about to take. It's a man who's taking life just one little bit too easily. And as a result of that, let's look at our fellow over here. So he's learning Torah, but not La'asoik. It's not Esek. When the Gemara says, if you're Oisek the Torah, if you're dealing in Torah, what does that mean? If you're dealing in Torah, that means that you're going to practice whatever you learn. Now it becomes urgent for me to understand it right. Because if I've understood it slightly incorrectly, it's going to affect the whole way I operate. Whereas if I don't practice what I learn, who cares what decisions I reach? Who cares what principles I uncover? I'm not going to use those principles in any case. No, says the Gemara, if you oisek the Torah, that means that you practice what you learn. And that makes your learning so much sharper. That means that when you're analyzing your learning, you've got to get it right. Otherwise, you're going to live wrongly. When you're learning that way, then the chos of matzlichim, then it works okay. Because if you're learning that way, then you have the intuitive field. You develop the talent. Well, let's start at the other end. Firstly, you're not bored. Not for 1 minute. This is now urgent stuff. It becomes exciting. Same as your last penny which you put into a business deal and it has to work. So here, when you're learning a piece of Gemara or a piece of Chumash, it has to come out right. Otherwise, it changes your whole life. When you're doing that, you're not bored. There's not Tim Hone Levov. There's perception, because there's jolly well got to be perception. You're alert for every little thing because your last penny is on it. Your whole life is wagered on this piece of learning that you're studying. And you'll keep your eyes open for the slightest deviation, for any warning light that you're not understanding properly. Your eyes are going to be open. And you're going to practice what you keep. And when you practice, you're going to practice what you learn. And when you practice what you learn, you develop talent. Because you develop the feel for what's right and what's wrong. What works and what doesn't work. What operates and what doesn't operate. What can be put together and what can't be put together. When you're doing it, when you learn, and then you try, and then you come back and you learn again, and you adjust, and you go back and try again, and you come back and you try again, and so it goes. That's when you develop talents for learning. You develop an ear for what sounds right and what sounds wrong, what looks right and what looks wrong. But if you're not practicing your Torah, that doesn't work. And then as a result of that, midah keneged midah, if you're prepared to learn Torah without investing it, If you're prepared to learn Torah without committing yourself to the results, then the Ribbono Shel takes no interest in all your other investments too. Then you're a type of person. And you're a type of person who thinks you just do and then you can forget about it. You don't realize the need to develop talent to achieve success in what you're doing. That really is the long and the short of the situation. Talent that we're talking about, or rather the degree of success that we're talking about, is based on an attitude to one's learning and an attitude to one's operation. There are two attitudes today that rule in learning Torah altogether, and not just in Torah, but in all areas. The one is an inward one, and the other is an outward one. The one is you come away from the world, you hide in Torah from the world. The other one is Torah is the central core. That's where you learn, that's where you analyze, and you look out at the world. With your Torah that you've acquired, with the principles you've learned, you now have the confidence to take strides into the world, to make changes, to approach it with a certain attitude, to dominate it, to be successful in it. That's one way of looking at it. So there's an inherent way of looking at Torah like a Shlemiel looks at it, and there's an inherent way of looking at it like a successful person looks at it. A successful person says, this Torah is important to me. Why is it important to me? Because I'm going to take it from the base of Medrash, and I'm going to go out into the world and I'm going to use it. And if I've learned it correctly, I'm going to be hurting people, I'm going to be doing destructive things to others and to myself. So it's got to be right. Because this Torah is for using, it's not just for learning. And the other is that this Torah is just for learning. And as a result, if the Torah is just for learning and not for using, you don't develop talent. If the Torah is just for learning and not for using, your perception gets weak. And if Torah is just for learning and not for using, you start getting bored. You start achieving emotional boredom and spiritual boredom. Because the human being is an active being. He's not just a head on a shoulder. He's a whole body, and he has a heart, and he has feelings, and he has emotions, and he has a spirit. And they all need to operate. And they all need to be active. And if you're not going to utilize them all, there's going to be boredom, there's going to be unclear perception, and there's going to be the first one. What is that? Sorry? Talent. The three things that we need for success.